Good day and welcome to the Cigna Eating Disorder Awareness Series conference call. As a reminder, today's conference is being recorded. And at this time, it is my pleasure to turn the presentation over to Kate Harner. Please go ahead.
Welcome, everyone, and thank you for calling in to Cigna's 2013 Eating Disorder Awareness Series. My name is Kate Harner, and I'm a care manager on the Eating Disorder team at Cigna. Due to the format of this call, you'll not be able to ask questions during the teleconference. At the end of the conference, you'll be transferred into a brief five-question survey in which we are requesting your feedback regarding your experience in today's seminar. After this survey, you will be able to ask questions of today's speaker. A handout for today's presentation is available online at www.cigna.com/eatingdisorders. Halfway down the page, under the heading Current Topics, you'll see the link for today's presentation in blue, entitled Eating Disorders and Self-Esteem. Again, visit the Awareness Series page online at www.cigna.com/eatingdisorders. Halfway down the page, under the heading Current Topics, you'll see the link for today's presentation in blue, entitled Eating Disorders and Self-Esteem. Please also notice the blue square in the top section of the page that you may click to sign up for the seminars. It's not required that you sign up in order to attend the monthly seminars. However, if you choose to do so, you will receive an email reminder for each month's presentation. Today, I have the pleasure of introducing Dr. Stephen Crawford. Dr. Crawford is the Associate Director of the Center for Eating Disorders at Sheppard Pratt. Today, he will be sharing information with us on eating disorders and self-esteem. Welcome, Dr. Crawford.
Well, thank you, Kate. I want to start off by thanking you for inviting me to do this presentation and thanking Cigna for hosting such, a great opportunity for the community with this Eating Disorder Awareness Series. In getting started, as you noted, I'll be talking today about self-esteem and eating disorders. And what we're going to be looking at is really, first, what exactly is self-esteem? And then we'll review factors that contribute to the development of self-esteem. From there, we'll start looking at how self-esteem can play a role in the development and actually the maintenance of eating disorders. And at the end, we'll look at what you can do to actually improve and work on developing a healthier self-esteem. So in getting started, at first, we'll look at what is self-esteem. Well, in figuring out what self-esteem is, it's helpful to start with what is it not. And I think it's really important to recognize that self-esteem is a sort of permanent state of being that exists throughout your lifetime. It's not a temporary feeling. It's not something that you get when you have a success or something that's induced by a drug, or when somebody pays you a compliment, or if you lose weight, and that's making you feel good. So it's not the reaction that occurs based on external achievements. It's really more of an internal sense of who you are. And an important additional point here is that sometimes people can confuse self-esteem with narcissism. And narcissism is sort of when a person is full of themselves and thinks that they're the next best thing to sliced bread, and it's really not about that being full of yourself. It's just more a sense of your self-worth, and that's where we're going to go next in the next slide, is what is self-esteem? And so self-esteem is really based on a sense of yourself as being competent to cope with the basic challenges of life. So you feel that whether or not you succeed in doing something, you're able to manage a challenge that comes your way. Self-esteem is essentially how we value ourselves and how valuable we think we are to those around us. It really gets down to your own sense of self-worth. And the self-esteem, in addition to that, is the experience that happiness is right and natural for us. In other words, that we are worthy of happiness, so that we don't need to earn happiness, but that just in our own being, we are worthy of happiness. Now, there are two components that come together to really define what self-esteem is. And the first one is self-respect. And self-respect is with this basic sense that you have self-worth just for existing. And again, I'll keep going back to this. It's not based on what you've done, but just for the fact that you are you, you have self-worth. And so you start with this basic thought, I am worthy and I am competent. And then you add to that a sense of self-efficacy. And what is self-efficacy? That is that you have the belief that you can complete tasks and reach goals that you set for yourself. So the person that's able to think to themselves, I can do this. And, you know, it's important to remind yourself when you're faced with a challenge, I can do this. And if you have that belief, that comes down to having self-efficacy. And self-efficacy does play a critical role in how we think, feel, and behave. So when you combine these two, in this next slide, you'll see self-respect and self-efficacy combined together to determine a person's self-esteem. It's important to note that it really is felt that self-esteem is necessary for survival. It is truly tied to a sense of personal control and competence. And studies have actually demonstrated that self-esteem is one of the best predictors of personal happiness. So now that we've talked about what self-esteem is, where does self-esteem come from? And so we're on to this slide has the heading nature. And it goes back to the old argument about nature versus nurture. In other words, are we born with self-esteem or do we learn self-esteem? And the answer is really that it's probably a combination of the two. And in terms of the biological genetic side, the nature side of things, you can look at that there may be certain inherent differences that make it easier or harder to attain a healthy self-esteem. An example would be if in life you have a goal of wanting to be a basketball player, but genetically you were born to be 5'2". Well, it's going to be harder for you to reach that goal, and that's going to impact your ability to achieve what you want to do and impact your sense of self, as opposed to the individual who's born genetically to be 6'8". Much in that way, there are inherent differences that people are born with that make it easier or harder for them to attain their self-esteem. And an example there would be genetically being preloaded with anxiety has been demonstrated to make it harder, not impossible, but harder for somebody to be able to attain a healthy sense of self. Moving on from nature, you look at nurture, and this is talking more about your environment and the things that you're exposed to as you're growing up. And studies have clearly demonstrated that children that are exposed to an environment that is filled with love, respect, acceptance, reasonable expectations, and a general belief in their goodness have an easier time developing a healthy sense of self as opposed to when children are exposed to an environment that has ridicule, humiliation, and is abusive. And now this environment can come from all sorts of places. It may be from the home, but it can also be from a school environment, a neighborhood environment. It can be from a teacher or a coach. It can be from anyone that's in that child's environment that's exposing them to love and respect or ridicule and humiliation can have an impact on the development of self-esteem for that individual. And if you go from there, you look at the different areas in somebody's life. And this takes us on to the pie chart, factors that influence self-esteem. And these are all the parts of a person's environment that may come together to impact their sense of self. So their home, their school environment, society in general, their job, and their social life. And within each of these factors, there are relationships and there are experiences that come together to determine someone's self-esteem. So when you look at the relationships in someone's job, it can be with their coworkers, their supervisors, the people that they supervise, and if they get along with everyone at work, They tend to feel better about themselves. And if they're having conflict with people at work all the time, then they end up having a lower sense of self. The experiences that you have at work equally can influence your self-esteem. So these experiences can be, if every time you get a new job and you have it for 6 months and you end up getting fired, that's going to have a negative impact on your self-esteem over time. And if every time you have it within your job, you're constantly every 6 months getting a promotion, that can have an impact on your self-esteem. But we will also notice when we're going down the road and talking about how you change your self-esteem, it's really important. It's not the actual event that determines your self-esteem, and I'll be coming back to this example. So it's not necessarily being fired that determines your self-esteem, but how you think about being fired that will end up determining your self-esteem. And we'll look more closely at that later on. Within the context of society, I don't have that drawn up, but within the context of society and eating disorders and self-esteem, certainly the marketing that goes on in our society with the messages that we need to buy certain products in order to feel better about ourselves do have an impact over time on self-esteem. Example is that a woman looking at a magazine with multiple ads and about products for only 3 minutes can have a negative impact on her body image. So then moving on from there, in summary, the roots of self-esteem are truly based in both what we're genetically born with and our genetic predisposition, as well as the environmental factors that we meet in our day-to-day life and how over time they contribute to our self-esteem. So if you start with the belief that a person has unconditional self-worth and that they're born with this worth regardless of what they've accomplished in their life, and then they're exposed to an environment of love and they grow up in a supportive, self-accepting, other-accepting environment, they can reach a very high self-esteem, and self-esteem grows. And a person that develops self-esteem will be able to live with what are referred to the pillars of self-esteem. And these pillars include a self-awareness, a self-acceptance that you are okay for who you are, a self-assertiveness, living purposefully with being able to set goals and have direction in your life, and living with integrity. So then moving on to what are the signs that a person has positive self-esteem. Well, an individual with positive self-esteem will display a sense of confidence. They will have self-direction. They will be optimistic about the future. They will have an independent and cooperative attitude. They will feel comfortable with a wide range of emotions, so they don't feel they always have to be happy if they're going to be an okay person and a good person and have lots of positive self-esteem. That it's okay once in a while to be sad. It's okay to be angry, and you can still feel good about yourself. You have an ability to trust others. You end up feeling that you have self-worth, so you're worthy of taking care of yourself. And finally, you also have the ability to say no. And that's really important, because if you are basing your self-esteem on what others think of you, and you're afraid if you say no, they're going to think less of you, and that's going to lower your self-worth. But if you feel that you have self-worth, regardless if this other person likes you or not, then you have an increased ability to say no, and not that it's going to change who you are as a person. On the next slide, we'll see that another sign of positive self-esteem is non-blaming behavior. And this is important, because if you have low self-esteem, you may actually be trying to build up your self-esteem by not acknowledging that you've made a mistake. And so if something goes wrong, you need to figure out who was at fault for this thing going wrong. And so you start engaging in blaming behavior. A person with positive self-esteem is able to accept that they may make mistakes and then learn from them. They're able to accept that others make mistakes as well, And if you're freed up from figuring out who is at fault and who you can blame, it leaves you room and time to actually solve problems. This, in the end, will lead to a person having a balanced view of themselves. So a person with positive self-esteem is aware of their personal strengths, and they also have a very solid sense of what their limitations are. So they're aware that they're not perfect, and they do have weaknesses, but that they also have strengths. So the balanced view of self really is a significant point of view of someone with positive self-esteem. This, in turn, when you have positive self-esteem, gives us the ability and our ability to learn from mistakes, because we can first acknowledge that we made a mistake, and then we can look at what we may do differently the next time and learn from that mistake. It frees us up to be able to make decisions for ourselves, because we are tolerant if we do make a mistake. And if you're worried that you don't want to make a mistake all the time, it inhibits you from feeling comfortable to make a decision. It gives you the ability to be flexible in life and to think independently for yourself and not look to others to make decisions for you, because you don't want to do something that may upset someone else. Here, it's really very important to note that you have to have confidence in your ability, not necessarily in your ability to succeed. So once again, stepping back from its external factors that determine your self-worth, but just in that it's your being. So as a person develops self-esteem and as they develop higher self-esteem, it increases their ability to cope with life's difficulties, and it also increases their ambition to move forward and set new goals for themselves. So then, now that we've looked at what positive self-esteem is, let's look at low self-esteem. And a person with low self-esteem may feel unworthy, incapable, and incompetent. They may have a sense that they're not able to accomplish tasks, and they're afraid to try new tasks because they're afraid of being failing, and if they fail, it will prove to everyone around them that they are a failure, and everyone will learn how terrible they are. So then low self-esteem can then end up actually preventing an individual from realizing their full potential because they're so afraid of trying new things in life. Signs that a person has low self-esteem are that they have a negative view of life. They end up having a perfectionistic attitude that they need to do everything right to have a sense that they're worthy. People with low self-esteem end up mistrusting others, even those that may be showing signs of affection towards them. They engage in the blaming behavior that we talked about. They may have feelings of being unloved and feel unlovable themselves. They have a growing sense of dependence, and this dependency puts them in a position where they're letting others make decisions for them. And finally, they live their life with a fear of being ridiculed. This leads a person with low self-esteem into a very, very vicious cycle. This vicious cycle can start with a person having a distorted view of themselves and others. So they have this view that they are a failure and they're not worthy. And since they're afraid of trying new experiences and afraid of putting themselves at risk for failing, they end up limiting their experiences that they're willing to try. And when they limit their experiences, it leads to a very narrow life that can promote a sense of unhappiness. If as you limit your experience, you become more convinced that you can't succeed and you lose a sense of confidence in your ability to succeed. And then when you're put in a position where you have to perform, you're so convinced that you can't perform that it ends up a self-fulfilling prophecy and you end up poorly performing. And then once you perform poorly, it reinforces the entire view that you're a failure, and it becomes this vicious cycle. This vicious cycle, as you'll see, gets played out in eating disorders as well. So the consequences of low self-esteem is that it can lead to all sorts of things, including compulsivity, a lack of achievement, relationship problems, behavior problems, depression, anxiety, and eating disorders. And it's really important to note that mental health has been equated with self-worth. So the better a person feels about themselves, the more confident a person has in themselves, the better their mental health. So this takes us up to the next part of the talk, and that will be about what eating disorders have to do with self-esteem and what self-esteem has to do with eating disorders. And this slide, my self-esteem's up 2 points this morning, is just a reminder that self-esteem is more of a permanent state. It's not environmentally influenced up and down on a day-to-day basis. Now, looking at self-esteem and eating disorders, it is important to note that low self-esteem has actually a central role in almost all clinical theories of eating disorders. And studies have shown clearly that eating disorders are associated with lower levels of self-esteem and a perception of self. Research also indicates that by increasing self-esteem, it really can help a person in their recovery from an eating disorder, so that working on self-esteem can be a significant aspect of the treatment. Now, this is a chart that lists predisposing factors, precipitating factors, and perpetuating factors, and you'll see that this sort of takes us back to that vicious cycle that I was reflecting on in terms of self-esteem. So we are, you know, born with genes, and some individuals are born with a genetic predisposition to develop an eating disorder. And then as they're exposed to life and experiences and in their environment, there may be all these predisposing factors, society, individual factors, family factors, cultural factors, school, work factors, that all may come together to contribute to a person increasingly sort of looking at their body shape, weight, and size as a determinant of who they are. And unfortunately, in our society, we really do place an overemphasis in general on our weight determining our self-worth. And then if you have the predisposition and are genetically loaded to develop an eating disorder, you can be at greater risk for developing an eating disorder. But if you start from a premise that your self-worth is based on your weight, and you want to improve your self-worth, then you're going to turn to dieting behaviors to increase your feelings of your self-worth. Dieting behaviors have been shown to clearly, very frequently result in disordered eating patterns. And that would lead you down the path to the eating disorder. Looking at the dieting behaviors, though, if you start losing some weight and you get positive reactions from the people around you and people are complimenting you for your weight loss, it's only going to reinforce the idea that weight loss is important to feeling good about yourself. So it contributes to this over-evaluation of body shape, weight, and size. Then you keep going down further and further into disordered eating, and that'll lead you into starvation symptoms. And research has shown us that as you go lower and lower in body weight, it can become biologically driven to try to lose more weight. So it some changes in your brain that will independently drive a person to pursue further and further weight loss. So this leads to the conclusion Chris Fairbairn had stated in 2003 that individuals with eating disorders possess a dysfunctional system for evaluating their self-worth. And that dysfunctional system really is the sense that they are what their weight is. And so if you are what your weight is, again, it leads you to try to control your weight to feel better about yourself. If you start restricting your intake and losing weight, two things can happen. One is it may make you so hungry and so ravenous that you can't tolerate restricting any longer and you start binge eating. And then if you binge, you feel horrible about yourself because you have you feel you have no self-control, and then you turn to purging to try to compensate for the intake, and then you feel even worse about yourself. On the other side, if you're restricting and restricting and losing more and more weight, and you get to lower and lower body weights, the starvation syndrome can kick in, and that's where biologically it's reinforced to pursue further low body weights. And then people can shift back and forth between the compensatory behaviors and the starvation component as well. Ironically, when people do this pattern, they actually feel worse and worse about themselves, and that only serves to perpetuate the cycle further. So low self-esteem has been implicated in the development of eating disorders, and low self-esteem is often the consequence of eating disorders. It's really the factor is that if the only way you can feel good about yourself is to lose weight, then the problem is you have to keep losing weight to feel okay about yourself, and that perpetuates this endless cycle. So we're going to be moving on to the next part of the talk, which is the good news, and that is that self-esteem can be cultivated. It can be inspired, stimulated, and coached. And people can practice certain ways of thinking and behaving that will actually increase their self-esteem. Now, how do we do this? Well, we start by doing an assessment, a personal assessment of our own self-esteem. To assess your own self-esteem, you want to be able to ask questions. And these questions include, am I shy, unassertive? Am I avoiding aspects of life? Am I controlling, obsessive? Do I have a basic sense of self-worth? Am I capable of doing things? Am I overly focused on my accomplishments? Am I aggressive towards other people? Am I confident in my ability to think, learn, and make appropriate decisions? And finally, two really important questions which get to the heart of self-esteem is, do I respect myself? Do I think I am worthy? And do I deserve to be happy? If in this assessment you end up feeling as though you have some room to work on your self-esteem, a clear treatment of choice is what we call cognitive behavioral therapy, or CBT. And CBT is actually the treatment of choice for self-esteem building. And an essence of CBT is that you can change the way you feel by changing the way you think and changing what you do. So there are these three components of life where you have your thoughts in your mind, you have your feelings about what's going on in your life, and you have the behaviors, what you're actually doing in life. And each one of these factors can influence the other. And because of that, CBT's premise is that by changing any one of these three, you can have an influence on the other two. So, well, how do we begin to make changes? Well, first we want to look at our thoughts and our attitudes. And this gets back to where I was talking in the beginning of the talk about that it's not about bad things happening to you that may influence your feelings, but it's about the thoughts you have about negative things that have happened to you that really can determine how you feel. So if you have this premise in your mind that you're stupid or you're lazy and a failure, if you have this concept everybody is better, smarter, or cuter than you, or there is something wrong with me, or you live your life constantly saying I shouldn't be so, or I should be more, or I ought to have done this, or I ought to have done that, then you're really setting yourself up to have this negative reaction to whatever occurs in your life. So an example would be that if you get fired from your job, and you end up losing your job. And one person may react to that by thinking, well, I totally am a failure. I'll never be able to get another job. This is just proof that I can never do anything right. Now, another person getting fired from the exact same job may have the thought, you know what? I was never really good at this job. I didn't like this job. It didn't play to what I'm good at. It didn't play on my strengths. I've been thinking about wanting to get another job, and I just haven't had the time to look around. Maybe this is an opportunity for me to go out and figure out what I really want to do in life. So you can see that same event, getting fired from the same job, may actually lead to two very different reactions and responses from the individual. Epictetus, who is the Greek sage and philosopher, said, "We are not disturbed by things, but by the view we take of them." And that sort of sums up what we're talking about. It's not the experience, but how we view the experience. So let's look a little more closely at thoughts and how they can impact a person with their life. So if a person has a thought, "I am a worthwhile person if I am popular and people like and respect me," and that's going to be how they determine if they have self-worth, then there are probably some advantages to living your life like that. One, you're going to work really, really hard to earn other people's respect, because by earning people's respect, you're going to feel you're a worthwhile person. And then when you do succeed in doing something and people actually like you, you're going to feel great about things. And finally, you're basing your sense of self-worth on other people's view of you, so you're going to go along with the crowd and do what they're recommending, because that way you'll continue to be popular. So you don't have to really think hard for yourself. Now, the disadvantages of that concept of you're worthwhile if you're popular and people like and respect you is that if someone doesn't like you, you could end up getting depressed. And the reality is, not everyone all the time is going to like you. So you put your own sense of self at risk if you determine that you're worthwhile only if you're popular and people like and respect you. And then on top of that, it sets you up that other people can really actually manipulate you, in that if they have a sense that you're a people pleaser and you want to do what they want you to do because that way you can feel good about yourself and think that they like you, then they can set it up that, you know, they're not going to like you unless you do something. And it may be something you don't want to do, but you're too worried about putting at risk your own sense of self-worth. So that's a disadvantage to that thought. So it really brings in this concept of assessing what makes a person worthwhile. How do you determine if you're a worthwhile person? Well, the question of what makes a person worthwhile begs the question, well, what is a worthless person? Are there worthless people? Is it somebody who fails at something, or somebody that makes a mistake? Is it somebody that nobody likes? And I think if you look around and look at the people in your life and ask your question, are any of the people in your life worthless? You know, people tend to have a different barometer for judging people around them than they judge themselves. So this asking what is a worthless person is really important towards looking then at your own sense of self-worth. So in doing that, you can also think to yourself, well, who is somebody in my life that I've admired and somebody that I've known and respected and really thought was worthwhile? And was it that they always wore a size 0 throughout their life that made them worthwhile? Or was it that they were kind, caring, and generous and really, really volunteered to help others in times of need? So what are the qualities that lead to somebody's sense of worth in the people that you have admired throughout your life? Takes you to the idea that self-esteem is actually the capacity to like and respect yourself, even when you don't succeed. And this actually is a pet peeve of mine. It's the cartoon with the self-esteem police go to the Olympics. Won't the people who don't win feel lousy about themselves? Why don't we just give everyone a medal that says participant? but that'll make all the non-participants feel inadequate. Well, the issue with this concept is it really misses the mark for developing self-esteem. Self-esteem is not about getting the medal. It's not about succeeding and the accomplishment. It's about feeling good enough about yourself to participate and to engage in life. And if you always win and never weather the storm of losing, if you always get that medal, then you don't have the opportunity to learn that you still are a person with self-worth whether or not you won. So you can lose and still be worthy in life. So, well, how do we, now that we've looked at our thoughts, begin to make changes in those thoughts and develop new thoughts and attitudes? Well, in CBT, we use self-monitoring thoughts, and we keep a daily thought record. And this record will be a person recording different events that have occurred to them throughout the course of the day that they have found to be upsetting. And then they look at possibly how these thoughts that they've had about upsetting events may be distorted. And by looking at the distortion, you're able to identify and generate more realistic positive thoughts. So let's take this example. You get a D on an exam. Your automatic thought to getting the D is, I'm a failure, I'm stupid, I'll never be a success at anything, I probably need to drop out of school. It leads to a feeling of shame and panic. Now, if you're doing the thought recording and you record this, you're able to step back and start to develop perhaps a more realistic thought. And this thought would be, well, you know, I do have a 3.6 GPA. I guess one test doesn't discount all the rest of my good grades. I usually do well on tests, so I probably will still graduate. Well, if you look at that, it changes the feeling that results from the thought from one of being devastated where you're going to have to drop out of college to one of being disappointed on doing poorly on one exam. When you're doing these thought walks, over time you're able to recognize some patterns that may exist in your thinking that may not be helpful to developing positive feelings about events in your life. And these thought patterns can be what's referred to as cognitive distortions. So you may have heard of people engaging in what's called all or nothing thinking. Well, all or nothing thinking is having a sense that if you're not perfect, if you don't do everything right, then you're a loser and you're not going to do anything right. And then there are these other types of cognitive distortions, overgeneralization. So you do something wrong and you assume that you do everything wrong and you ruin everything. You jump to conclusions. So your friend is more quiet than usual and you end up thinking, well, he's mad at me and what did I do wrong? And you're personalizing it without really knowing why he's quiet. For all you know, he has laryngitis. Then the next thing is discounting the positive. Someone compliments you on your work and you say, well, anyone can do that. That was no big deal. And so you're minimizing your successes. If you use labeling, you miss a basketball shot and say, well, I'm the biggest loser ever. So, you know, you're setting yourself up to not make the next shot. And magnification would be if a student answers a professor's question incorrectly and immediately thinks that the teacher now thinks he's stupid and that he's going to fail. Well, let's look at, now that you've been looking at your thoughts, you've been keeping the thought log, you've been looking at the distortions in your thoughts, and you've been trying to develop more realistic thinking, you take that to change your behavior next. So you start by trying to identify situations that may make you feel inferior or feel bad about yourself. You identify the situation, you look at your emotional reaction to the situation, then you start identifying your thoughts, and finally you identify your typical response. So let's look at parties. And look at that as an example. If you know that every time you go to a party, you feel extremely anxious and you're embarrassed all the time, well, it's not the party making you feel anxious and embarrassed, and you have to think, well, what's the thought behind the feeling? Well, the thought would be, I don't have anything important to say. People don't want to talk to me. And that's why it makes you anxious, because you are afraid people are going to not want to listen to anything you have to say. So the consequence of that is you end up avoiding parties altogether. So you want to start to challenge this thought so that you can engage in life and participate in life. And so to challenge that thought, you may want to start thinking, well, you know, maybe I'm being too extreme here. It's not true that I never have something to say. And there's actually no evidence, really, that I'm any more boring than anyone else. So now that you have this more realistic thought, you want to look at, okay, how do you challenge this? How do you adapt a more adaptive reaction? And the thing would be not to avoid going to parties, which tends to be the outcome of the original thought. So if you decide you're going to challenge this behavior and not avoid parties, you want to develop a plan for yourself so you can be successful going to the next party. And in order to do that, you want to plan to go with a friend, stay for a brief time. You want to start at a small gathering, so you're not going to some big a gala where there's going to be hundreds of people, and you're going to practice some positive self-talk. You're going to go back to that thought, I can do this. And then you're going to set a goal for yourself, like you're going to talk to three new people, and you're going to work towards achieving that goal. And then when you go to the party and then you come home, you may think, well, you know, that wasn't so bad. And you may be more willing to go the next time. So the goal here is to engage in behaviors that build self-esteem. You're going to increase pleasurable activities, increase rewarding activities, and you're going to increase activities that promote a self-reliance. On top of this, you're going to be monitoring pleasurable activities. So to monitor pleasurable activities, you want to look at some activity and what you predict will be your satisfaction in that activity, and then what was your actual satisfaction. Well, an example here would be an art lesson. So if you're going to go to a new art lesson, you may be worried that, you know, you may not be able to do the artwork required, you may not like your teacher, and you may not know anybody in the class, and they may be all sorts of people that you don't like. And so you're worried about it, but you do want to take the class, so maybe 50% sense of satisfaction at the end. And then when you go, you may actually really do well in the art class. Your teacher may be fantastic and dynamic, and you may know two people in the class, and they really get along with you, and so your actual satisfaction ends up being 80%. Well, now, if you take that and look at an eating disorder behavior like binge eating, you may think to yourself, well, you've been planning to have this binge all day long. You're really looking forward to the binge. You've planned it out. You're going to have time to yourself to binge away, and you're really thinking you're going to have 70% satisfaction with the binge, but you get there, you eat, you binge. At the end of the binge, you feel really guilty, you feel horrible about yourself, and your actual satisfaction was maybe 40% at best, probably lower, and so that's giving you a sense of, is the anticipated pleasurable activity as pleasurable as you anticipate, and is it something you want to continue or something you want to change? So an overall review of building self-esteem is looking at assessing your self-esteem, increasing awareness of your thoughts of yourself, increasing your understanding of your self-worth. Then you monitor and challenge your distorted thinking, monitor and challenge negative behaviors. And then you want to start incorporating pleasurable, rewarding behaviors. And then the important point here is you need to practice those behaviors. Practice, 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 so that you can change your behaviors and change your thoughts. So a final point here is conditional self-esteem versus unconditional self-esteem. And this gets back to the whole point is we are not worthwhile because of our accomplishments. And we are not worthwhile because we have success in life. And then the consequence of having conditional self-esteem is if you don't succeed, you will think that you're a failure and that you have failed. Whereas with unconditional self-esteem, you already start from a premise that you are a worthwhile person, that you don't have to earn being a worthwhile person, and you are worthwhile simply because you exist. So unconditional self-esteem advantages are that you're worthwhile even when you're having a tough time in life or you've had some failures. You won't be so afraid that you may fail, and that you will always feel equal to other people regardless of what you've succeeded. And you won't have to get defensive if somebody's criticizing you, because your self-esteem isn't on the line or on that one moment where somebody's upset with you. And then you can enjoy life more because you won't use up all your energy worrying about whether you're good enough or not. In conclusion, Nathaniel Braden, who is really a pioneer in the work on self-esteem, said, of all the judgments we pass in life, none is more important than the judgment we pass on ourselves. And so that brings me to the end of my presentation for today. Thank you very much.
And to help us evaluate and improve our program, please complete the following short survey. If you are a Cigna employee, we ask that you please refrain from participating in the survey. After the last question, there will be an opportunity for you to ask questions. Your individual responses will be kept confidential. First question, this session provided me with a better understanding of how self-esteem and eating disorders impact each other. Press star 1 for strongly agree, star 2 for agree, star 3 for disagree, or star 4 for strongly disagree. Again, that's star 1 for strongly agree, star 2 for agree, star 3 for disagree, or star 4 for strongly disagree. This session educated me on techniques to improve self-esteem and self-worth. Press star 1 for strongly agree. Press star 2 for agree. Star 3 for disagree. Or star 4 for strongly disagree. Again, this session educated me on techniques to improve self-esteem and self-worth. Press star 1 for strongly agree, star 2 for agree, star 3 for disagree, or star 4 for strongly disagree. Overall, this session met my expectations. Please select one of the following responses. Press star 1 for strongly agree, star 2 for agree, star 3 for disagree, or star 4 for strongly disagree. And overall, this session met my expectations. Star 1 for strongly agree, star 2 for agree, star 3 for disagree, or star 4 for strongly disagree. Next question. I would recommend this program to others. Press star 1 if you agree, or star 2 if you do not agree. Once again, I would recommend this program to others. Press star 1 if you agree, or star 2 if you do not agree. And please select the response that best describes your role in the life of an individual with an eating disorder. Press star 1 for I am an individual with an eating disorder. Star 2, I am a family member of someone with an eating disorder. Press star 3 for I am a health professional, or star 4 for others. Once again, please select the response that best describes your role in the life of an individual with an eating disorder. That's star 1 for I am an individual with an eating disorder. Press star 2 for I am a family member of someone with an eating disorder. That's star 3 for I am a health professional, or star 4 for others. And this does conclude today's short survey. We appreciate everyone's participation. If you would like to signal for a question, please press star 1 on your telephone keypad at this time. Once again, if you'd like to signal for a question, press star 1. If you've been listening via speakerphone, please make sure your mute button is off. Once again, that is star 1 for questions for those over the phone. And at this time, it appears that we do have no questions in the phone queue. I'd like to turn the presentation back to today's presenters for any additional or closing remarks.
Okay. Okay, I wanted to say thank you to everyone for attending, and a special thank you to Dr. Stephen Crawford for providing us all with such wonderful insights today. If anyone listening has specific questions about any of the therapies discussed, please contact the Eating Disorder team by calling the number on the back of your insurance card. Please also be sure to mark your calendars to join our next Eating Disorder Awareness Seminar next month on Tuesday, August 27th at 1 o'clock Eastern. That's noon Central and 10 a.m. Pacific. Thanks, everyone.
And this does conclude today's presentation. We thank everyone for their participation.